Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Adrian Ryan of Spectology, and we are going to be discussing Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, which won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1970. So, Adrian, thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on here, Seth. I've been listening and enjoying the podcast for, I want to say, like 4 or 5 months now, and I'm excited to get to be on. I've listened to a bunch of the back episodes, too.
Cool. Yeah, and likewise, I was able to go back and listen to your catalog as well for the books that I've actually read.
Right. Right. Yeah, we get pretty in-depth, so...
Yeah. Well, why don't you talk about Spectology? What's it all about?
Yeah. So Spectology is another science fiction kind of book club podcast. We do it a little bit differently. We tend to pick more modern books. I'd say books mostly from the last 10 years. And we dig into them over 2 episodes. We do a pre-read episode where we kind of talk about the like context. Both me and my co-host Matt have been science fiction readers for a very long time, and we have friends in the industry. So we'll talk about the context of what the book is in discussion with, what older books it's in discussion with, that kind of thing. And then for the post-read episode, we dig really deep, honestly, really deep into the themes and kind of like what like social point that the book is making. We're both really interested in kind of that. And we both have a kind of like a lit theory background in college, very different kinds of lit theory, but we, kind of come at it from that angle. And then we also do like bonus kind of like fun little episodes from time to time too, but it's mostly those kind of like 2 episodes a month.
Nice.
Yeah, well, it's fun.
I do not have a lit theory background, so I'll lean on you for some of that today. How about that?
Yeah, sounds good. I've tried, I always try not to go too far down that road too. So
Yeah. Therein lies madness.
Right. Yes. Although I think this book in particular, I think Le Guin has a lit theory background herself, so it'll be kind of interesting to talk about some of that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So why don't you talk about some of your history as a science fiction fan? You mentioned that.
Oh, yeah, totally. So I've been reading science fiction since my dad gave me one of like Arthur C. Clarke's books when I was like a real little kid. So So like you, Seth, I grew up in Alaska. I grew up in a smaller town called Homer, like south of Anchorage. You're from Anchorage, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I had family up in Anchorage. My mom's parents or my mom's mom lived in Anchorage and some of her sisters and stuff. So I was up there a lot. But I grew up in a little town called Homer, and I actually grew up out of Homer. So I live like 15 miles out of the town that is literally called the end of the road in Alaska. Right.
It totally is the end of the road, too.
It is. That's our motto.
Drive down onto the spit,
Yep. So I lived like 15 miles past the end of the road in like a little like kind of, more or less a cabin my dad built without running water with, so we did have electricity, luckily. But it's a very kind of like, out there experience. Yeah. And so science fiction was something I loved, he liked reading like adventure stories and stuff to me, but I really liked the science fiction stuff because it was a bit of an escape from the, growing up, like, on the one hand, it's like we have the internet, and on the other hand, we have like an outhouse, and it's, this kind of like in both worlds kind of situation. And so I always, kind of dreamed about that. And then now I, live in New York City, so I kind of, went full circle into the science fiction world.
Yeah, it's funny because like growing up in Anchorage, even though it's a city and you're essentially, you're living in a normal city, mm-hmm. it still felt like you're like Luke Skywalker, on the far edge of the galaxy,
Totally.
What did he say in Star Wars? If there's a bright center to the galaxy, you're in the state where it's farthest from. That's what it always felt like to me. But it actually was more like that.
Right. Well, for me, it was like Anchorage felt like a big city. Right. But even then, like I said, I spent a lot of time in Anchorage, and even up there, you're nestled in between like the mountains and the water just as much as you are in Homer. Every time I fly into Anchorage, it's like, oh yeah, that's right. There's like giant mountains right here. And then there's like Sleeping Lady and all that. So it's like, I would say that, and you're a little bit older than I am, I think too. Uh-huh. So you probably, my experience of Anchorage, just like when I was growing up, was that it was modernizing a lot. And so I'm sure when you were growing up, it was much less so even.
Yeah. Yeah. Anchorage in the 70s is not the same as it is today.
No, definitely. That's, I guess, when my mom was kind of like leaving Anchorage, was around then. So
okay.
she grew up in, Wasilla, I think. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a different experience than Anchorage too.
Right.
I always tell people I'm from Anchorage, and they're like, "Oh, yeah, you must love to hunt and fish." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I did some fishing, but I was basically a city kid." So,
yep, totally. Yeah, I mean, this is the funny thing about me. It was like I was basically a city kid, even though I'd never been to a city before. It's like kind of like raised in the backwoods, but like city kid at heart, which is why like living in New York works pretty well for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my history of science fiction really comes from that. It was always like, you know, especially growing up, like we were very poor, so it was like we had the public library. I just read an insane amount of books. I was going through actually the Hugo books that I'd read, and I've read 31 of them, which was actually less than I thought. Hmm. And I have to admit, 5 of those are books that I started and then like didn't finish because I didn't like them at some point. Okay. I'm very aggressive about not finishing books I don't like. But I read a ton of these kind of books and then stopped when I came out here for college, stopped reading. You're in college, there's less time for pleasure reading anyway. Yeah. And then afterwards kind of picked it up again. And Matt, my co-host on Spectology, and I kind of like both kind of re-picked it up at the same time. He recommended a lot of more modern science fiction to me because I'd mostly read like the old stuff when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now I started the science fiction book club subreddit on Reddit and like another like r/printsf on Reddit. So I did that like 10 years ago and was getting, getting really into science fiction again. And then, kind of did the podcast because it's just like, I love talking about this stuff and I love having like kind of deep, too deep conversations about it. So, someone wrote a review of our podcast. It's like, oh, it's like the best kind of bullshitty conversations you'd have in college. It's like, yep, that's what I'm going for.
Yeah. Well, my Hugo count is now up to 28.
Cool. Yeah, I'm at 26 actually read and finished the books. You're ahead of me on that count.
I'm very curious to know the ones that you gave up on.
Honestly, people are going to get really mad at me. I gave up on Dune. I've tried starting Dune twice and I've never been able to finish it. It's something about his writing style in particular. Like I can't get over the like close omniscient third person. Like it gives me like whiplash while I'm reading. I have a really, really hard time with it. And then there were a few other two. I think there was like a Heinlein on there. Like I've read almost all of Heinlein's novels, but there's like one or two that I've read part of and like didn't end up finishing. I actually like some of his other novels that didn't win the Hugos a lot more. And that's true for I think the other one was the there's a couple of the older novels that I just like don't hold up as well for me. And I've tried starting them and just kind of like, I can read something later that I feel like works better.
Yeah. And some of those, you know, I probably wouldn't read them if I didn't have the podcast. So.
Right. Right. I think A Case for Conscience was one of those. It's like, I read part of it. It's like, I just want to read like A Canticle for Leibowitz again.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting.
So, I've also read a ton of that I've loved, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why this book? Why did you choose The Left Hand of Darkness?
Yeah, so this book was one that Matt actually introduced me to when I was just starting to like pick up science fiction again, and it's one that kind of I really love this book. I hadn't read it for like 5 or 6 years, so part of it was like, oh, cool, I get a chance to like revisit a book that I haven't in a while, but also like I know it well enough, so it's a little bit easier to like commit to reading it in a month.
Absolutely.
For a podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's so I am, I don't want to get too deep into spoilers, and I think we talked a little bit about this. Like, this book is one, it's really... Like, on the one hand, it's really hard to talk about without spoiling it. But on the other hand, it's really hard to spoil it because it kind of spoils itself really early on. And so I'm going to be super vague about it until we get into spoilers and people can kind of just decide from there. But it's one that is very like anthropological and sociological. Like it's really, there is a plot, but it is more about the like history and culture and like psychology and sociology of like the people that you meet than it is like... about the plot itself. I mean, like the book does actually give away what happens at the end, kind of at the very beginning. And so from that perspective, it's, I just really like that kind of thing. Like it's kind of like a slow methodological, like story about these like people going through very, very extreme circumstances. And then I think too, just going back to the Alaska piece, it's like set on this world of forever winter, which I thought would be fun for me and you to talk about a little bit too.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely do want to talk about that. Because there's, There's something about reading about people being super cold that really resonates.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's like both uncomfortable, but also like familiar.
Yep. Yep. In a way. Like, oh yeah, I know the way you smell when you come in from being really cold, but also working hard.
Right. Right. Like that mist feeling that comes off you. It's really cold at like it's like sub-zero, but you're still in a t-shirt because you're working so hard that you're like sweating and steaming.
And steaming, yeah.
Outside.
Yep.
And my dad used to work on the North Slope, like the oil fields in the very like north of Alaska, where it gets mm-hmm. like real, real cold. I mean, much right. colder than Homer does. Homer is like even a lot warmer than Anchorage is in the winters. Right. Like we're well, on it's the water.
Sheltered from the water, essentially, right? So
exactly. So we have Homer is pretty mild as far as Alaska towns go, which of course is like still very extreme by like most places. But
right.
But you know, hearing him tell stories of like, you know. I don't know. His stories remind me a lot of this book in a way, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. So let's try and do a brief non-spoiler as much as possible discussion. Yeah. And then we'll just kind of abbreviate that and go straight into spoilers. But sort of in vague terms, can you do any kind of a, you know, synopsis or elevator pitch for it?
Yeah, I think my elevator pitch for this book would be it's about a person named Genry I who is an ambassador from kind of an intergalactic civilization to a small backwoods planet that he is trying to like help bring into the civilization. And it's the story of like how he is trying to do that. And in particular, one person, like a native of that planet on the ground, who is also working with him at it. And it's a story of like both their relationship over kind of the years that they're trying to do this, as well as his preconceived notion of like what these people are like and him like realizing how little he actually knows about their culture and like through realizing his own ignorance, like understanding the culture a lot better.
Kind right.
of that thing where it's like you have to realize what you don't know to learn. Mm-hmm.
It's all through interaction with a person that he learns right. that stuff, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's their relationship is like very important. And then two, there's so that's like about two-thirds of the book. And then also every other chapter, not quite every other chapter, but almost every other chapter, there's like a small kind of like maybe sometimes it's like a myth, sometimes it's an origin story, sometimes it's like legends or history from the people of the world. So it's kind of the book reads in some ways like a report from a ambassador to another country after yes. they've come back and they're writing up the report. And some ways like a... an ethnography, like an anthropological text. And so mm-hmm. there's all these like stories from the people of the place that he is. And it's his way of like, here, I'm telling you these, their stories so you can understand them a little bit better, understand how they think about themselves a little bit better. So yeah. in that way, the plotting is very slow because every other chapter like just kind of stops and you get like a story from history from these people. Mm-hmm. But the thematically, it creates a very dense book.
It does. And it's interesting because it's only, you know, 300 pages or so, and mm-hmm. it reads, I'm not going to say it reads like it's much longer. I heard another podcaster say recently that if this book were written today, it would be 800 pages long because they'd give you the whole history of the ecumen and all this other stuff. And here I feel like it is dense in a lot of ways, and by that I mean, and you may mean as well, that it packs a lot of information into 300 pages without being a slog.
Right. It's like rich is maybe a word instead of dense.
There we go.
It's like yeah. every word has like 10 meanings to it mm-hmm. on the page.
Yeah. I feel like there's great economy of world building here where mm-hmm. the way that she builds out that world kind of, you know, a chapter at a time really works for me, where a lot of times in science fiction and fantasy world building, I'm like, I don't need to know this. But here I felt like every little bit of information was kind of crucial to understanding the book.
Right. And she kind of doles it out like one chapter after you want to know it, which yes. I think helps with that a lot. And it's like you're as ignorant as Genry I is. And that mm-hmm. helps a lot. Like you learn stuff as he does, more or less.
So I think it's funny you pronounce his name like the people in Carhide do.
Oh, right. Yeah. So I listened to the audiobook of this, which is the first time I've ever listened to the audiobook. Oh, okay. And so it's in my head, just like the pronunciation I heard the most frequently was right. that.
Okay. Yeah, because they couldn't pronounce the L, right? Because
right.
think it's
so Genli. His name is Genli Ai, yeah. and they call him Genri or Genri Ai the whole
right.
time.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then I guess there's the other character we should say is Harth Remir Estraven, mostly called Estraven, and he's kind of like the person on the ground.
Right. Yeah, I think before we switch into spoilers, let's talk about other recommended reading kind of based on this, or if you've read this other thing, you might like The Left Hand of Darkness.
Right. So what I did was I went through the books that you have already read on this podcast. And I was like, okay, what of these have I read? And I also think are kind of like similar in some way. And the two big ones for me were Speaker for the Dead and A Canticle for Leibowitz. Like, I think if you enjoyed either of those two books, you'll probably enjoy this one.
Sure.
They're both about these kind of longer historical things. They both have a really deep, like, anthropological element, especially like your Speaker for the Dead also kind of reads like an ethnography in a way.
Yeah.
And A Canticle for Leibowitz has this like deep history thing going on that Ursula K. Le Guin has in here. And then the other two, which are, and they're also both, I think, a little bit more like slower literary fiction type books like this one is. The other two, which are, you know, I think stylistically less similar but have some similar themes, would be Hyperion and Lord of Light.
Yeah.
I think especially Hyperion telling all of these different stories about these different cultures throughout this galaxy. And then Lord of Light, I think in particular, I don't know how much we'll get into this, but like Le Guin was really influenced by Taoism and Buddhism and kind of her own personal philosophy. And I think you see a lot of that in this book in a way that is not explicit at all, but like there's that kind of thematic element of it. So I like practice Buddhism. And so that kind of like was really interesting to me, kind of like seeing some of those like ideas more than anything else pop up.
Nice.
And then I will say too, if you've read this book, the other thing probably, if you just like history and anthropology, like if you've ever read Margaret Mead or like 1491 or like, you know, history kind of podcasts or something, I think you might enjoy this book just as like from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And then the final book I want to give a shout out, which is if you liked this book, I think a book that is almost even better is this out of print book by Maureen McHugh called Mission Child. It's available for like a few dollars. You can get like the hardcover on like Amazon or Abe Books or wherever you get like used books online. It's one of my favorite books ever, and it deals with a lot of the same kind of stuff, like the land of forever winter, these kind of like themes of colonization and colonies and decolonization, and also some of the like gender stuff that we'll get into. And it handles a lot of it, I don't know. It's like it's a more recent book, and I think it handles some of it a little bit like better, frankly. And it's just one of my favorite, like the way it's written, everything is just perfect. I'm so sad that it's out of print. You can't get it on ebook or anything, but it's called Mission Child, and it's worth, if you liked this book, it's totally worth picking up.
Cool. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I say we just go ahead and dive right into spoilers.
Cool. Yeah. So the big spoiler here is that, because we don't actually learn it for a while, right? I was listening to it again, and I forgot how long it takes in the book before you pick up on the fact that the people of Gethin, the planet, also called Winter, don't have any gender. I guess like she calls them androgynous. I think scientifically they're hermaphroditic, but they can...
Yeah, ambisexual is what I kind of understood.
Right. So the idea is more or less like they go into heat, more or less. They call it Kemmer, but like once a month, like during what, you know, more or less on like a woman's like menstrual cycle, they go into what's called Kemmer, and for a week they exhibit sexual characteristics, which they can exhibit either male or female sexual characteristics. Any person will like do one or the other at different times. And they only have sexual characteristics during that time. And because they can be either, there isn't gender in the way that we think about it.
Right. And they're fertile both ways too, right?
Right. Exactly. So some, you know, and the same person might become a mother and then later become a father,
right.
You know, or be a father and later become a mother. You know, and so a lot of the book, one of the interesting things about the book is that it's told from Genli's point of view. And he genders everyone because he can't help it, because yes. he's so I guess as we're saying, everyone is human. The idea is that it's kind of like far in the future, humans have settled the galaxy, mm-hmm. and then like civilization fell, and then they're kind of trying to rebuild civilization, and like, you know, 50,000 years later, get in contact with all these planets that haven't been in contact for a long time. So these are, they're humans, but they were somehow genetically altered to like have this like, you know, kind of like ambisexual
right.
situation. And so Genli calls everyone him and he, mm-hmm. even though they're not, like that's not actually appropriate. And that right. kind of tension of like the way he thinks about people versus the way they actually are is a big point in tension in the book. And I think it's kind of interesting the way that, we can talk about more of this later, but you know, he is very kind of like a gender essentialist. Like he talks a lot about like the importance of being a man and a woman and how you're born, and it like determines all these things. And then he's presented with this culture where like none of that is true,
yeah.
you know, where they're, everyone's just a person in the same way, and there isn't gender, and you know, and he's like, oh, you're a king, but like, no, you're a king queen, you're both.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the king is pregnant. You're like, wait, what?
Right. right.
Yeah. It's a fascinating concept. The idea of the ambisexuality, right. And that you're fertile both ways, that you could become a mother and a father, and mm-hmm. how that would impact things like marriage customs, right? Because they really, they mm-hmm. do have it, right? You can vow Khmer to someone.
Mm-hmm.
But there's restrictions on that as well. But there's other things that are just like taboos that we have that they don't, right? Where
right.
even if you just look at sexuality in general, it's like there's no repression. It's just, well, this is the time that everybody gets busy and there's right. no particular guilt about it. It's just their world. It's just how things are.
Well, and you know, one of the things they talk about is there's like a, you know, humans are sort of like low-key always sexual, whereas for them it's like they pack all of that sexuality into like 3 or 4 days out of a month, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the month they don't have any sexual tension, they don't have any sexual desire or anything, yeah. it's just like not an issue for them. So it goes beyond just like the which sex are you to the fact of like, when you're not in Khmer, you don't think about sex. It's not even a possibility and not something that you're hormonally kind of like attuned to in any way.
Sure. And is it coincidence that they have no concept of war?
Right. I mean, I think Le Guin doesn't think so.
Yeah.
You know, no. I think she's very much in the camp of like, you know, gender causes war in some way. I think it's worth saying that the book was published in 1969 and, mm-hmm. you know, written a couple of years before that. And so it definitely falls into the kind of like second wave radical feminism
yes.
type of feminism, you know. And Le Guin obviously herself kind of like changed over time and changed her own thinking. But I think like the book is a, and did you read the foreword? Did your edition have the foreword to the
yeah,
book in it? Her foreword?
I did.
So I want to call this out because I think this is like the foreword to The Left Hand of Darkness, which was published in the 1976 edition. The original edition didn't have it. And it's, I think, been published in every edition since then, is one of the best essays on the purpose of science fiction that I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much about her theory of like this. And it's, you know, for her, it's like the science fiction that I write is not trying to predict the future. I am writing about now through a speculative lens. So I'm writing about humans as they exist now, and I'm telling truth by telling lies. It's kind of like
yes.
this theme she brings up over and over again. And I think that's important context for this book of like, she is writing about the late 60s,
mm-hmm.
you know, she is not trying to say like, oh, in the future, like men will be like this, or like there will be ambisexual people, or, you know, like, you know, Genli's like, you know, kind of like ideas about sexuality was like, we'll still have those gender norms in the future. Rather, it's right now, this is the way people think, and I'm writing about the way people think now, and I'm observing mm-hmm. the world around me and changing just a little bit to make it what's now more clear through those changes.
Yeah. And it's interesting too how timely the novel is given all the kind of more understanding we have now about transgender and transsexual mm-hmm. and you know, I kind of feel like Genli I to some extent, where I'm like assuming people's gender.
Right.
It's just because of it's, I mean, I don't want to blame it on the just, well, it's the way I am, you know, but it mm-hmm. really is. I mean, it's kind of the way society was. And so it's something that's hard to adjust to. And I have a former coworker who's trans, and like, sometimes I'm like, I want to talk to you and just find out what this experience is like, 'cause I have no clue.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, I feel the same way sometimes, and I'm an even, you know, kind of like a half generation younger than you. And it's mm-hmm. still for me, like, you know, I have friends who are trans and I still get stuff wrong, and it's like, you know, but I don't want to, 'cause I, you know, believe them and like they exist, right. you know, yeah, and all of yeah. that. But it's also, it's like this kind of hard. And I think that it's one of the things I like about the book is that it, you know, by seeing this through Genly's eyes, mm-hmm. Genly's eyes, you know, you're kind of put in this position of like, you know, ignorance without realizing ignorance, and then ignorance with like acceptance of that ignorance. You kind of right. like see that like, oh, that's actually like an important part of the learning process, is like just being okay with your own ignorance and being like, you know, willing to say like, hey, I'm wrong about things and I don't understand things yeah. fully. And I think that that's a kind of like very compassionate view of like, you know, he becomes a more compassionate person mm-hmm. by admitting his own ignorance, which sure. is, you know, something I like a lot.
I wonder if she wrote the book today. I mean, I know she passed away, which is unfortunate. Right. If she would have made it a little less heteronormative.
Yeah, I think so.
Because, yeah, it still does come off as well, but they still pair up, you know, in Kemmer. You know, you if you mm-hmm. exhibit female, then you seek a male, which makes sense in a reproductive sense, right?
Right.
You know, I'm sure that she didn't intend it to be exclusionary of anything about homosexuality.
Right, right. And I think, like, Genly mentions homosexuality in passing at some point. Mm. And it's kind of interesting because he mentions it as a thing that is, you know, mostly still taboo and mostly still, you know, and again, it's like her writing about the late 60s as opposed to like
yes.
the future. It's like this, you know, he almost reads as someone from the late 60s, like doing his best in the situation. Mm-hmm. And I think so. It's something that I definitely was, when I was reading it, I had forgotten just how kind of gender essentialist it is. 'Cause there's also points where it talks about like, oh, you know, women tend not to be composers or scientists and this sort of thing. And it's like,
right.
sure. But there's also a lot of like social conditions that cause that, sure. you know, we're not yeah, getting yeah. into it all. And sure, it's not the point of the book, but it's also, you know, it's interesting. I have read some of her science fiction novels and stories, mostly from the 60s and 70s. I haven't read anything that she's written more recently. She was writing up until her death this past January. Mm-hmm. And I know that like Tin House magazine published one of her last short stories like a couple months ago and that sort of thing. And like we have one of her like books of essays that just got published. And it makes me want to like go back and read some of her like, you know, writing in the last 10 years about this stuff and
yeah,
see
yeah.
how her own ideas changed and whatnot, because it's, you know, I mean, I think like Genly, it's like, yeah, you change over time as you realize kind of like what the world out there is like. Mm-hmm. But even so, I think, you know, for all of that, you know, the book is not actually about homosexuality or queerness
right.
or transgenderism or whatever. It is rather about like cisgender people, like by being about these kind of like androgynous or ambisexual folks, it's actually about like cisgender kind of like heterosexual people. And like, that's actually who she's writing about.
Yes.
By having this like such extreme, you know, kind of science fantasy sort of thing, we get to like look at ourselves and be like, oh yeah, I do these things. And it's partially because of the way I was raised in this particular society
right.
built around these gender norms.
Well, I wanted to make sure that we got back to talking about Taoism and Buddhism, if you wanted to talk about some of that, because there is, you know, for people who haven't read it, I know people still listen to the spoiler section, even if they haven't read the book.
I just did it for your last episode.
Okay, nice. But, you know, you have you have Karhide, which is a monarchy, mm-hmm. you know, essentially, it could be the UK, right?
Right. Yeah, like 200 years ago or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't go a ton into how the government actually functions. You just have – you know there's a king, right? And there's a
right.
powerful person under the king.
Right. It feels like Victorian era, kind of like a little bit of like constitutional monarchy, but the monarchy is still actually very important.
Right. I thought it was fascinating when there was a radio address by TB. That's the way the audio – thing that I listened to called him looks like Tybe, but
yeah, it was Tybe in my audio version.
Okay,
so
interesting. The radio address sounded exactly like Donald Trump, you know, talking about securing our borders.
And, totally.
And totally. I was just like, wow, that is straight out of his playbook.
Right. But then, well, when I first read this, it was during the Bush era. And so there's all this stuff about patriotism and yes. What is patriotism is a major theme. And that was, you know, very like, oh, wow. Yeah. What, you know,
yeah.
written in the 60s. And we had the same conversation, I guess there was kind of based around the Vietnam War and the Indochina War at that point. But,
yep.
you know, it's like we still have the same questions of like, can you be patriot and not want war?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then the other nation is Orgeron, which mm-hmm. it has to be kind of a bastardization of Oregon, because I think she was from
Oh,
Portland.
Funny. Yeah, so. Yeah. She grew up, or not grew up in, but she lived in Portland as an adult. Yeah.
Which, woohoo, Oregon.
Yeah.
but they're more communistic, right?
I mean, that's like a straight up like Stalinism without Stalin. It's like it has kind of like a council, but it's a very clear like Stalinist or maybe like Jewish style system. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting too that he gets there and everybody's really friendly and then he ends up in the gulag. And
right. Yeah.
And that was awful. Like the whole, he gets picked up at some point in some kind of random raid and mistaken mm-hmm. for somebody else more or less, and takes this long truck or van ride, which is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's a tribute to her writing that, you know, while the content of it was cringy and you're like, oh man, that's awful. It was really compelling to read, and then, you know, gets rescued from that and then still ends up in the gulag.
Right.
Which is awful as well.
Yeah. The, you know, worker farm or whatever they call it.
Voluntary the, like, worker farm, right?
Yeah. Which I think is just straight out of Stalinist Russia. I think that's just the same term that they were using at that point. Which it is interesting because, just to go on a quick tangent, like Le Guin herself was like a lifelong anti-capitalist and mm-hmm. like, you know, very, very like, but she was also, she was an anarchist and she was like a, you know,
yeah,
like, a socialist anarchist. And so it's kind of interesting to read like her take on Stalinist Russia now, when you have like sort of a lot of like the kind of like certain left wing internet, like tanky Stalinist apologia. And it's like, no, you can be left wing and like not think that was good. And like, here's a good version of why. I'll also shout out, there's a phenomenal book called Secondhand Time by Svetlana Alexievich, which is, also, actually, if you like this book, that's another very good one. It's kind of nonfiction. It's this woman who does these, she goes around and she does like more or less like makes recordings of like oral histories of like people's time in the Soviet Union. Mm. And then she rewrites them in their first person voice, but like with her like being a very, very good writer. So it's sort of this like narrative nonfiction with like her own stylistic and, you know, kind of like semi-journalistic thing put on top of it. But you have a bunch of stories about people in the gulags in that. It's about the fall of the Soviet Union. And this book is very true to that. Mm-hmm. And this feeling of like, you know, being here, the helplessness. And even, you know, at one point when Estreven comes to like rescue I, he points out, it's like, anyone could have walked out at any time. Like right. Like the thing that's keeping you here is both like your own fear as well as just like the wilderness.
Yeah.
That it's thousands of miles across ice sheets to like anything else.
Yeah. That reminded me of Rescue Dawn. It's a Werner Herzog movie with Christian Bale.
Oh, cool. I've never seen that. No,
it's good. But there, he's in a prison camp, essentially in a POW camp in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about escaping, and somebody is like, yeah, we could leave, but the jungle is the prison.
Right.
And it's a similar thing, only, you know, kind of the opposite, like the threat of heat and contagion and bugs and all that kind of stuff. But
right.
Yeah. At some point I was going to ask you to describe to me the time when you were the coldest. We don't have to do that right now if you don't want to, but
No, that's a really good question. It's hard to think of any one specific example.
Yeah.
I've definitely, right. Cause one of the interesting things is like when it gets really cold, you only go outside to like do active stuff. And like the act, you know, it's that weird thing of they describe it of like, they're, you know, like they're on an ice sheet, they're on a glacier and it's like negative 20 degrees and they're like stripped down to their t-shirts because they're like essentially running for miles and miles and miles the whole time. And I've definitely experienced that. We used to go out snow machining and, you know, like backcountry snowboarding and stuff like that. And especially like, you know, you get the snow machine stuck and all of a sudden you're like peeling off your layers as you're like digging out the snow because it's just such hard work and it's so intense. And
well, and sweating inside your coat isn't helpful later on down the line.
No, then you'll get real cold real quick. You know, much better to be in your base layer, which wicks it away and evaporates it. And then I actually, one of the coldest I've ever been, strangely enough, was I went back to Alaska after being in college and it was... it was like negative 20 or 30 degrees in Homer. It was like as cold as it had ever been in Homer when I'd been there. And I just remember, you know, I was flying. I flew from Anchorage to Homer. Usually I would drive, but this time I had to fly. No one could pick me up. And you're in these little like puddle hopper kind of like propeller airplanes. And it like I just remember being inside the airplane and it was like negative 10 degrees, like inside the airplane as you're flying. And like that, you know, it's so cold outside. And it, you know, I think like when it gets really cold like that, the air gets dry, like everything kind of evaporates out of the air and your skin gets really dry. So when your skin gets like exposed to that kind of cold, like it can actually crack. Like I've, you know, definitely like bumped into something and just watched my skin like split, you know, and just sort of like, it's a very interesting experience. Like the cold doesn't quite feel like you think it will. I'm curious, what's the coldest you've ever been? That's a really good question.
I mean, I've got a couple things, but I was going to say like in grade school, you know, you go out for recess and it's just, you know, it's minus 20 or something. And to some extent, I always tell people, you know, once it's below zero, it kind of all feels the same. It's just a matter of how fast the changes happen in your exposed skin. Right. And so like my memory of grade school is just always having a split lip. Right. Like having chapped lips constantly from like November to April.
Yeah.
Or
like that dry, flaky, like cheek skin that just kind of.
Yep. And the little kind of frayed around the edges on your lips, you know, you're like, I'm just going to pull this one off. And then it splits open and you're like, dang it. Right. And it takes forever to heal. It's probably mostly hockey. Cause I played hockey when I was
totally
like in, you know, middle school.
Yeah.
And we played at Mulcahy Stadium in Anchorage. And it's outdoors. You know, you're playing hockey outdoors and in February it might be the minus 20, but if the wind kicks up. Yeah. It's so bad. And while you're out there on the ice playing, you're fine, right? There's not a lot of extra layers you can put on over your hockey pads because, you know, you don't have a jacket that's three sizes too big to go over your pads. and so you're basically in a like thermal underwear, a sweatshirt, and then your hockey jersey, and that's it. And when it's super cold, if you're out there on the ice, you're good. But then you come back to the bench, and like the coach would put a towel down on the bench. Otherwise, you'd stick to it. Because you'd be sweating and you'd develop a little layer of sweat ice that held you to the bench. They'd have to come and chip you off of it. But the other time I went skiing at Alyeska in Girdwood, just outside Anchorage, and it was – I think it was late February, and it was a beautiful day. It was in kind of the mid-30s, bright and sunny, which feels like 50 degrees when you're skiing.
Totally.
And so – We always brought like our heaviest parkas for skiing. But then if it was a nice day, we would take them off and just, you know, be in a sweater.
Totally.
And so we were doing that day and it was gorgeous. It was wonderful. And we're like, okay, one last run. Let's go up to the top. We got on the quad lift and got like 2/3 of the way up there and it stopped and it didn't move.
No.
It didn't move for 45 minutes. And the sun started going down and the clouds rolled in and the wind picked
up. And you're
up
higher, so the wind is really there when you're in the lift.
Exactly. And the temperature dropped like 60 degrees. It got down to like minus 30 while we're sitting there. And fortunately, it was a bubble lift, so at least there was some protection from it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But we were up there for almost an hour before they could get us down. And it never started again. They had to feed up a T-bar for us to rappel down on. I've never been that cold. Like, you know, the uncontrollable shivering is just, it's something that it was visceral when reading this and them talking about how cold it was and the experience of once you've gone out in the cold and then come back in, like you're like, I'm not going back out. It's mm-hmm. you cannot get me out there. And that's exactly
no, there's a psychological factor of like, you're not doing it.
Yeah.
There's also, that actually reminds me because I played hockey too. And one thing I remember is like, you get on the ice, you'd work up a sweat, you'd come out and you'd be on the bench. You'd be really, really cold. And we had like an indoor kind of like warm area.
Yeah.
And you'd have to force yourself not to go in there. Cause if you actually warm up again, you're just not coming back out. It's like that thing of like, oh yeah, you keep everything kind of cold just so you're, mm-hmm. it's like better to be always a little bit cold than to sometimes be really warm. Cause when you get really warm, you're done. You've ruined the whole thing for yourself.
Yeah. And then the time is when my feet would get cold inside the skates and they're these, you know, hard plastic skates. It's not like you can pick your feet up and rub them or anything. You just gotta like it. They're not going to get warm until I'm in a warm place and I take my skates off.
Yep. Yeah. And you just kind of gotta like let them get past the point that they hurt and they're just cold.
Yeah. Good times.
Definitely. The other time I've been really cold was in the summer, actually canoeing with my dad and his brother. And we tipped the canoe over in like, I think it was just the Anchor River or something, somewhere on the Kenai Peninsula. And, like dunking in like a glacial river, even in the summer, and getting pulled out and just like, you know, we're swimming around and trying to get all this stuff and like flip over the canoe and like deal with everything. And you get out and like you're wet. All your layers are wet. Everything you have is wet.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you're so cold. And it's this thing of like, you just can't, you know, that water, especially the water, like won't let you get warm again.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about, the Handara or the Handarata, if you wanted to talk about Taoism and Buddhism and those influences.
I don't know how much I actually have to say about the like Taoist influences, but I did really enjoy the, just this whole element of, you know, and one piece of it, and I talk about this a lot, is that, like on the podcast, my own podcast, is that I'm always disappointed when science fiction books about other cultures don't include some element of like belief and cult and faith and all of this. Like, it's such a key element of the human experience, faith is. And so, yeah, and I think there's this kind of like thing of like, oh, in the future we'll all be like science atheists kind of thing. And it's like,
right.
We won't. Like, yeah. No.
It's a science fiction author's pipe dream.
Right, exactly. And so, I really enjoyed this, just this element of like, you know, they have these very specific types of religions. They're not necessarily similar to, you know, Christianity or like the major religions of the West or whatever, you know, like, and because it is like a science fiction, science fantasy novel, it's like they actually have some like power beyond like faith. Right. Like they have this foretelling ability. And the like the thing that gets built of like, okay, they have this like scientific explanation for like why they can do the foretelling. But then on top of that, they have this social explanation for why they can do the foretelling and the social structures and rituals around the foretelling that are like very, very important. And a lot of this idea, which I think is kind of the like, you know, Buddhist Taoist influence, is like, sure, I can tell you the future, but it ultimately doesn't do you any good to know it.
Right.
You know, it's like,
yeah, there's a quote, we perfected the art of foretelling to exhibit the perfect uselessness of knowing the answer to the wrong question.
Right. Which, like, okay, maybe that is or isn't why they perfected the art of foretelling, but, like, that's the effect of it, essentially.
Yeah.
It's like, if you can only have one question answered, you're going to be disappointed no matter what that answer is.
Sure.
And there's that point of, like, you know, everyone's final answer is the same. Like, at some point you die. This is something that in you know, in Buddhism where they're, you know, there's the Zen Buddhism I practice, there's this kind of idea of karma and stuff, but there's, like, ultimately the idea is like, you have one life to live. Like, what are you going to do with it? And like that, that is this big thing of like, since you only have one life as the person you are now, like, sure, karma, reincarnation, but like, you're not that person, you know, at that point, like, what do you do with that life? How do you live that life? And like, what can you do? And how do you stay present? You know, a lot of the mindful stuff is like, how do you stay present in the life and to the experiences that you have? Cause you only get to have those experiences once. So better to like be there while they happen.
Yeah.
And I think there's some of that element of this, of like, sure, you know, and a lot of this, like, it's always year one for them. They're kind of like this presentism thing that a lot of the Genthians practice in different ways, I think, is kind of an element of this, of like, you know, ultimately the answer is the same for everyone. So like, the more important thing is like what you do until you get to that answer, as opposed to like knowing the answer. Cause like, you know, the answer, you will die at some point. Like that is part of life, is death. And so the rest of life is the important part, and that's actually up to you. And like, you need to take personal responsibility for that and like deal with it.
I really like the relationship between I and Estraven, just because it starts off kind of antagonistic. I mean, like, I is expecting Estraven is going to plead his cause, right? And all he wants to do is get this planet to join the Ecumen of Known Worlds, or whatever it's called, right? It's they're not joining.
It's like a trade organization.
Yeah. It's not even like a treaty that, you know, they're not going to be ruled by anyone, right? They're just going to establish communication and trade, right? So it seems like a pretty minor thing, but they do it one person at a time, right? Because one person is a curiosity, two is an invasion, right?
Right. Well, and there's also the element of like Genly realizes over time that by being alone, he has to understand the other people in order to bring them in. Whereas if he were with other people, he wouldn't be changed. And like, the actual point is as much to change him as it is for him to change them, which I thought was kind of this cool, almost like reveal of him realizing like, oh, I had to change to bring them in, not the other way around.
Yeah. And so it's fascinating where it starts that way. And then he feels betrayed by Estraven and really doesn't like him. It's impossible
it's
to
hard,
do, right?
Right.
And then finally comes to understand what Estraven had been trying to do, and is rescued by him, you know. And I find the evolution of their relationship to be very compelling, very sweet. It's the kind of friendship I think you could probably only have with someone who you've barely survived something with.
Yeah. Right. Right. But also like the kind of friendship where you realize how important they were to you for like such a long time. And like this sort of feeling of like, you know, like hate is not the opposite of love thing. Mm-hmm. It's like he could only be so upset because he cared so much.
Right.
Like Genly could only be so upset because he cared so much. And I liked that element of it a lot, too. Yeah. Plus just this element of like, I mean, being in those kind of tough survival situations, you know, I've never been in anything nearly that extreme, but I've also been in like pretty intense situations at points in my life. And like, yeah, you build it, even with someone you hate, you build a bond with them. Yeah. And, you know, and clearly like they don't hate each other. They had misunderstandings, and like both of them misunderstood the other person's purpose and what they were trying to do and all of that. But ultimately they like build this bond, and you know, it's believable too. It's like you believe over time as they realize like, oh, like Genly only ever wanted me to give him advice. And he thought that I, you know, he didn't think that I was like to give him advice is not speaking down to him. He wants advice. Whereas like to one of my people, it would be speaking down to them. And similarly, you know, there's some really interesting stuff about like crying, like Genly like won't let himself to cry out of this sort of like, you know, like largely gendered thing,
macho,
but also, right. But then there's also this element of like, you know, Estraven, for all of his like cool calculating ways, is more able easily to do that. And like Genly sees that at some point and it's like, oh, right. That's right. Like, he does have feelings, you know, and it's like, it's in this element of like, oh, that's right. He is a person and he's not just a, he, like they have feelings and their feelings are different from the way mine work. And some of that is biological and some of that is just social. Like, you know, the element of, you know, being allowed to cry or not, that is not like inherent to our biology. That is like a social construct that we've built up of like who is and isn't allowed to cry and what that means when they do. I don't know. It's funny. I don't have like a whole ton to say about the relationship other than I think it's really sweet. And it's really like a nice look at how people can misunderstand each other for so long, but still feel affection for each other and kind of like come to that affection. I'm actually curious what you think of Estraven's death at the end, because that's something that's always puzzled me a little bit.
Yeah. I wasn't totally sure what to make of it. And there is some talk in the book about the dishonor of suicide, right? Where if you look back in Estevan's past, right? And I didn't even realize it was talking about him at first, where he had vowed Kemmer with a brother, right?
Right.
And then the brother had committed suicide because they weren't allowed to be together. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge problem, right? A huge social issue.
Right.
And the dishonor for that suicide landed on Estevan. Mm-hmm. And so then the idea that he would more or less kind of commit suicide by cop at the end, you're like, is that him just sort of finally completing what started with his brother?
Right.
Or is he doing that because he knows that I being attached to him was going to be dangerous for Genli being, yeah,
right,
for him.
Right.
And so he's like, he's going to come with me. It's too much of a danger for him. I have to put myself out of the equation. That was kind of the way I saw it.
Yeah. I wondered if there was some element of Genli having changed Estevan enough that he's able to put aside this taboo and be like, my whole existence is for bringing my people into the Ecumen. And right. If I have to die to do that, I do. And that's this thought that most Genthians would never be able to have, but he was able to have it because of the influence that Genli had had over him over the years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is partially just this thing that's unknowable. Le Guin does not give us an answer because in death there are no answer, in other people's deaths especially. So it was just kind of that I had remembered that he does die at the end. I had forgotten exactly the way, and listening to it again was like, oh yeah, what does this mean? How does this affect him? Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that I think you're totally right that the story of the brothers vowing Kemmer to each other was him and his brother, or him and his sibling.
Right.
Actually, yeah. here's a question. Do you think, all else being equal, would this book be stronger and maybe make its point better if it did use some sort of gender neutral pronouns, or maybe switch to gender neutral pronouns at certain points? It's something I've struggled with a little bit.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think so, because I think part of the book's strength is we are identifying with Genli, right? He is the gender duality person, right? Binary gender. And so the fact of him using the specific gender pronouns is how we would do it, right? And so to see him move away from that into slowly realizing, wait, Estevan is not a man and he's not a woman. And see, I said he the whole time there.
Right.
To me, it pulled me into the character viewpoint effectively.
It did for me too, especially in his chapters. I almost wonder if in some of the other chapters, if when Estevan is writing about himself and his people, him,
right.
if when Estevan are doing, they had used a different pronoun, that could potentially be interesting as a way to show the difference between Genli's point of view and everyone else's. I often think about this kind of stuff, and it's not to say that she wrote a bad book or anything. It just reading it again, it made me curious of how would someone write this book differently now? Take everything else being the same, what sort of things would you do now that are, maybe slightly different? But also, does that maybe make a different point at the end than what Le Guin is trying to make? Maybe it does.
Yeah. One of the things that I did not love about the book was the specific terminology, where there's a specific word for every day of the month.
Yeah.
Rather than just counting. Because if it was just the month names being different, that would have been fine with me. But it took me a while to figure out what those were about. In the diaries. Where I thought, oh, is this just them using some of their native language, saying Nusuth or Shifgrithor or the other things, right? I can tolerate a certain amount of improvisation about language and that kind of stuff. It's something I'm interested in, but that was just kind of one of those specific things that didn't really work for me.
Yeah, I just sort of filter that out entirely.
Yeah, it took me a while to filter it out. It was distracting at first.
Oh, interesting. Probably, I think the audiobook helped with that, because it was just he would say a word and I'd be like, I didn't catch that, whatever. Just sort of it's easier. Yeah, the thing with, because I don't remember if I said this on mic or not. I listened to this book, and it's the first, like, I've read it two or three times in the past, and it's the first time I've ever listened to the audiobook of it. And like, I don't normally listen to audiobooks, it's just that I've been ridiculously busy and it was the only way I was going to finish it, and I figured, like, hey, I've read it before. So, but it does, like, listening to the audiobook for me feels a little bit at times like skimming, like I'm definitely not getting 100% of it in the same way that I am when I'm reading. And so some of it, I think stuff like that was actually easier a little bit, just because it was like, okay, words I remember from past reads, that it's like days of the month, and like it just does not matter.
Yeah,
like you don't, there's no close reading to do. It's not like, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire where you can like figure out the connections and like actually like, oh, it's hinting that this is the, it's none of that. It's purely world building and like atmosphere. Yeah. And so it's very easy to just kind of ignore for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to ask about the audiobook. Is it just one narrator?
Yeah, it's one narrator. Honestly, it's not the best audiobook I've ever listened to. I've not listened to a whole ton of audiobooks. It's one kind of like older gentleman narrator, and he does a sort of, you know, a more masculine voice for Genly, and then a kind of more like middle ground voice for everyone else. It's just like a slightly higher register. It's fine. I'm not like a huge audiobook fan. I think the only audiobook I've ever listened to where I was like, oh wow, that was an experience and I'm glad I listened to the audiobook, was Secondhand Time, the book about Soviet Russia that I mentioned earlier. That there's a whole cast of narrators, and they get different narrators, like every chapter has a different narrator essentially, and so it feels like this oral history of all these different people kind of like talking about their experiences in a really cool way.
Well, if you wanted to check out an audiobook, kind of going back to a conversation earlier about Dune, there is an excellent audiobook version of that that has more than one narrator. It's not a full cast production exactly.
Interesting. Yeah.
But it does help to set the mood for some of the scenes.
That sounds interesting. I would probably enjoy that more than reading it. I might pick that up.
Yeah. So I picked up, I thought it was an audiobook through my library, just through the Libby app, an audio production that was a BBC radio adaptation of The Left Hand of Darkness, and it's only 2.5 hours long, so it's more or less like a
it's
movie.
Like a radio play,
yeah, like a radio play, and but like a movie adaptation almost, right? Where I heard a quote one time that said, if you're striving for a faithful adaptation, the best that you can possibly hope for is a skillful abridgment.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily something to shoot for, where you can try and take things a different direction, right, and make something that transcends the original work. But that's more about my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader.
Right. Well, that'll be our conversation on Spectology when you're a guest. Will be exactly. All about this.
Yeah, right. But the BBC one was interesting because it was a male narrator for Genly, and then Estevan was played by an actress named Leslie Sharp, who doesn't have a super high pitched voice. But it made sense because it was kind of all framed around the, you know, discussions in the tent.
Yeah.
It kind of spun out from there. And then, you know, once it got past that point, it did something different. But so the fact that it was a female narrator female reader for Estevan made some sense just because Kemmer had happened, right?
Right. Yeah.
And it made sense to have a more masculine voice for Genly than for Estevan at any time.
Right. I like that idea of having like a female actress, but calling her him, and like that, you know, it's one of these ways that adaptations can sometimes like make a text like more full.
Yeah.
And like, that does sort of show this difference of like, you know, Genly keeps calling him, while it's like this clearly like female actress playing this part. And even if she's made more androgynous in the way she speaks or whatever, it's still this kind of like, you see and feel that tension instead of like on the page. Sometimes the tension, I think, gets lost a little bit, even when it's supposed to be there.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I have no idea how this could be adapted to film. It would be really
interesting. I think someone tried once and failed, so.
Yeah. I think there's been stage adaptations of it, and I could see that working. But you're not going to go very far into what Kemmer looks like, right?
Right. I think, honestly, this is the kind of thing that it does not make sense for film, but would make sense for kind of like a mini series, like a 10-episode prestige type drama thing would make a lot of sense. And you could do some kind of cool things with the like sexuality and gender, and maybe even like use different actors for like the same part at different times or whatnot. Or like, you know, I think too, in like a kind of more episodic, like, you know, like 10 episodes, you could actually have some like standalone episodes or standalone scenes that are telling some of these like historical or legendary type stories in a way that you can't in a movie. You just don't have enough time to go through that and like dig into that more deeply. It's something when I was reading this, I was thinking about, it's like, oh, I don't ever want to see a movie of this, but I would love like a 10 episode drama of it. Like if, you know, if Amazon or someone wants to pick that up, I would definitely watch that.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Have you read any other of Le Guin's books? I'm curious.
I don't believe I have.
Okay. The other book I've read of hers was also set in the Hainish cycle called The Word for World is Forest. Hmm. And that one is really interesting. It actually touches on gender a lot less and is a lot more about like the colonialism. And like, we could talk about colonialism in this book, but it's pretty far to the side compared to the other themes. Whereas that one is very much about like colonialism and resource extraction and what, you know, kind of like what a pre-ecumenical society going to another planet looks like. And it's, so it's an interesting contrast like that, which is pre-ecumen and kind of like earthlings going to another planet to extract its resources, as opposed to the ecumenical, like coming to help bring them into this thing. You know, it reads almost more like the culture novels and Contact than it does like any sort of like, you know, rah, rah, like go out and, you know, like get their stuff from them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Tame the savages.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of that kind of talk in Word for World is Forest. It's interesting.
Huh?
Yeah. That's also like a novella, so it can be read in like an afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, I may pick up some more of these, but you know, there's always more books to read.
Always. So. Yeah. I never have enough time.
Well, any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah. It's a book that I really like. It's interesting reading it again and being like, oh, now as I've changed, like I have certain criticisms of it that I never had before. But also I think at the time, like, you know, it was really helpful for me to read it when I did, you know? And so it's definitely, and just I wish more science fiction books took this kind of like slow methodological, like anthropological, like look at the worlds that they're dealing with. That's still one of my favorite parts about the novel. You know, Le Guin's father was an anthropologist. And so like she had experience like on like doing anthropology and like with an anthropologist father and everything. And so I think that, you know, it's something you don't see a whole lot of back then or now. And you know, it's sort of like probably my favorite part of the novel still is just this like way that it's willing to just kind of like sit with these histories and not in kind of like a, like sometimes fantasy novels will do this and it's a little bit like, I don't know. I don't want to be too mean, but it can get a little bit like, all right, like you're really enamored with the world that you've built. And like, this never feels like that.
No, it
never
doesn't.
Feels like that. It's rather, it's like really trying to like, you know, there's a compassion to this novel. Like I've said that word a few times. It's like, the novel's very compassionate towards every single one of its characters, towards like everyone, ever the societies, like all of it. And I really like that attitude that it takes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely recommend the book still. I think it's also like you said, it's 300 words. It's really dense. And it's also like, it's more fun than I feel like we've made it than we've talked about it. Like, it's cool. It's really cool and weird and fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I ever really said at the top, but I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was terrific. This is going to rank up to towards the top of the books that I've read here. I have Speaker for the Dead at the top just because it's been kind of my favorite book for a long time. And it's hard to unseat it, but not because any of the, I could probably admit that several of the books are definitely better than Speaker for the Dead.
Right.
But in terms of my enjoyment, I'm keeping that one at the top.
There's a difference between favorite and best. And I think that's an important difference to like keep hold of.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been thinking of going back and kind of re-ranking, trying to be a little more objective about it. But I mean, it's all subjective.
Nah, do it for yourself.
Yeah. There we go. Good call. I will. So before we sign off, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm on, you know, Twitter, Adrian M. Ryan, at Adrian M. Ryan on Twitter. I mostly don't tweet about, like, I tweet mostly about politics because I, like, my day job is in politics. So if you don't want to read that, don't follow me there. I do have the spectology.com is our podcast website. We're also on Twitter at SpectologyPod. And that's more where like I tweet about science fiction from that account and do that kind of stuff. And then, and the podcast, it's fun. We do like a, you know, if you like this discussion I had here, it's the same kind of thing over and over again. So,
well, and then you do the kind of in conversation episodes as well, right?
Yeah. So we do both like in-depth book conversation episodes. And then we also do sort of like topic based conversational episodes. Mm-hmm. We talked about, like ebooks versus audiobooks versus physical books recently.
That was a great episode.
With a listener of ours. Yeah. Cool. I'm glad you liked it. That was so fun to record. And I definitely, I felt like I learned stuff about myself recording that episode, which is always fun. Like what I like. That's actually, that episode is part of why I listened to this on audiobook. I was like, oh, I should try something different. It's been a long time. We had Tobias Buckel on at one point. He's a science fiction author, to talk about Caribbean science fiction. And that's one of my favorite episodes I always talk about, because it's like this whole genre of science fiction that I knew nothing about coming into it. And I've been trying to read some of the books that he mentioned for us, and they've all been like phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. That may have been the first one I listened to. That was pretty early on, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. That was like 3 or 4 months ago. We've only been going for 7 months. Yeah, this was just our 7th book that we read, The Ballad of Black Tom. So it's, you know, we're all pretty new at it. It's definitely, the quality has been getting better each month, like audio quality, just like our quality of conversation, all of it. So it's been fun. I'm definitely happy to be doing it. And it's fun to, you know, meet people through too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I was coming up with the concept for the podcast here, I thought, you know what, I'm just going to try and find as many other podcasters who are simpatico, you know, who like to read books, or maybe even people who are more into movies, you know, and get them to read a book and come and talk and share their perspectives. Cause it's a cool thing to do.
Yeah. If I can just say, like, I love the Hugo's There podcast. I like the focus of it, the, like, you know, that you do it once a month, that you have a guest each time, that it's really focused on, like, you know, it's like you can read such a diverse array of books, both in like time and subgenre and author and all of this, but they still have this thematic thing of like they've all won this one particular award. It's really cool. I like the way you've done that. So I've enjoyed listening to these episodes.
Awesome. I appreciate that.
Cool. Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, Adrian, I really want to thank you for doing this, and I'm looking forward to my guest spot on Inspectology when we finally get around to making that happen.
Yeah, and hopefully before the end of the month. We're super busy, so hopefully we can do that.
Great. Well,
good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Adrian, and I definitely encourage you to check out Spectology. We do have a plan for a future episode of Spectology that I guest on, so I'm looking forward to that. So, as always, thank you so much for listening, and check out our website, hugospodcast.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/hugospodcast. Follow us on Twitter, @HugosPodcast. Send me a note there. Let me know you're listening. And of course, you can send me recommendations for future guests, or if you want to volunteer to pick a title, go up to the website, pick one, fill out the contact form, and send that to me, and we'll get it done. And if you'd like to leave us a review in iTunes or however you listen to us, please do that. I'd appreciate it. I actually had a review in iTunes that gave me some constructive feedback that I didn't need to keep repeating the fact that I wasn't much of a reader, and now I am. And I didn't even realize I was doing that. It's just kind of something that comes up as part of the conversation. But in future podcasts, I'm removing that because the listener has heard it, even if my guest hasn't. So thank you to that listener who gave me that constructive feedback. It's always good to make the show better. And I think that'll about do it for this time. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.